This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show is hosted by Marco Arment, the creator, founder of Instapaper and the magazine. And by me, I'm Dan Benjamin. Today is November 12th, 2012. It is Monday. This is episode 103. We would like to say thanks very much to our sponsors, lynda.com, squarespace.com, and hover.com, which we will tell you about as the show continues. We also want to say thanks very much to Mutual Mobile. These guys are passionate about iOS as a platform. They have a large, dedicated team solely dedicated to conceiving, delivering, and supporting mobile solutions for global brands. They give their engineers the freedom to make technical decisions by hiring smart, talented people to their team. You have the advantage of working alongside fantastic designers and pushing the boundaries of iOS. And that's the thing. They want you to be a member of their team. And they made a special page for you to go to learn more about this. They're a great bunch of folks. careers.mutualmobile.com/5x5 is where you go to learn more. Great company to work for. Bandwidth for November is brought to you by MindNode, an intuitive mind mapping app for Mac and iOS all this month. They let you collect, structure, and expand your ideas. They have integrated iCloud sharing. You have your mind maps with you wherever you go. Awesome for brainstorming. Go check them out at mindnode.com. Hello, Marco.
Show?
Yeah, this is the show. How are you doing?
This is what people tune in for?
This is why people listen.
I did want to do a brief bit of follow-up on Back to Work this week.
Okay.
You guys were mentioning, I think, well, you were at least mentioning, you're recalling how back in June when I did the Howard Stern ad for Instapaper, you mentioned that during that episode of this show, when we were talking about it and when we played it, you know, it has that like bed music under it.
Yeah.
That like generic, like doing stuff, rocking kind of music that's under a lot of, you know, crappy radio ads. Well, and it's also under like all those stupid, you know, those, I won't name names here, but those formulaic internet video podcast type shows that are like, here's a 5-minute overview of the news in this vertical. And it's like a talking head with a green screen going through the news with a little picture on the side. And it's like, just, it's like you could have gotten all that information just from reading like the one top blog in that vertical. But it's like that stupid formula of show that like that always has that stupid bedding music under it too. And it drives me crazy. But anyway, there's the leaf blower.
I hear it.
That's all right. They're doing the area right in front of my window, but that'll be done in a few minutes, and then it'll be further away areas, and then it'll be easier to just hear me without that. Anyway, so this is literally like, you know how my desk is right next to a window?
Yeah, and in fact, I noticed that
on the other side of that window right now, the leaf blower is 6 feet away from me.
It's really not that bad. So can I put into the show notes that picture of you?
Yeah.
Having family time.
What?
The picture of you having family time with you and your son and the nest in the background and your office.
Oh, yeah. If it shows the window and everything. Yeah, sure.
I think it shows the window. I don't care. I'm putting it in the notes.
Yeah, put it in there. Who cares?
Done.
I know what it looks like. Everyone else knows what it looks like, too. All right. So, anyway, when you were talking about that, you mentioned how during that show, you put bedding music under our ad reads as a joke, and nobody got that it was a joke.
Well, they were. I think a few people did, but not enough. people.
So I didn't think it was a joke, and I actually thought, hey, this is something we should try. Like, let's give it a shot. The reason why the Howard Stern show does that, the reason why they put those music under the reads, is first of all, they do more ads than you. And that kind of complicates this, but basically they put it in there to help differentiate the ad from the show.
Right.
And so the way you do things, you know, this is a different format, way fewer people, way less going on auditorially or whatever that word would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have like all sorts of, you know, intros and outros and, you know, commercials in the middle with background music going on back and forth. Like, so anyway, they put the music on to differentiate it from the show. And one benefit that has is that they don't have to then begin every sponsor with, let me tell you about our, you know, fourth sponsor of the week, blah, 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 blah. Here's their copy. Like, they don't have to prefix every ad read with that. So it's very obvious when it's an ad. So I think there actually is merit to that idea. And I think that's why we tried it and we were a little bit serious in trying it. It was an attempt. I think if it would have worked and if people would have said, oh, this is great, then you probably would have kept it.
Well,
I don't necessarily believe you that you were totally joking. I think you were actually trying it.
Here's the thing. In my mind, I said, well, we'll do this to be funny, to generate some humor. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, if people really, really like it, then yeah, I mean, I guess I can do it. But,
and there were like those two guys who did like it.
There were a couple people in somewhere in Guam.
It was not wrote, zero. It was like two solid people who liked it a lot.
Exactly. Anyway, yeah, I mean, it was something that definitely if the response had been like overwhelmingly positive, then yes, I would have considered doing it more. However, as I anticipated, people either said nothing or despised it. I wasn't gonna do it. I mean, listen, you and I both, we're huge fans of talk radio. So for me, the fact that we don't do that is actually like a concession that I had made, just because when I started doing the shows, I was always the one editing them. And also, right, I feel like there's an element of it sounding a little bit too overproduced in a way. Like it can come across cheesy or something somehow.
It
like
depends on the context, you know. It really does. Like in a context like the Howard Stern show, which is this very produced show with a staff of a ton of people, that's, you know, like very, very like rich sounding, and like, you know, they have Fred doing all the sound effects for the whole thing and everything. Like there's a lot going on there, and so in the context of that show, it works. You know, as well as something like that can work. In the context of your shows, where it's only like, you know, two people talking in this much more intimate sounding setting, without constant sound effects and music playing all the time, it's a lot more jarring. I think it doesn't really fit in that context, you know. Like I feel like it would almost fit better like in an, I know they wouldn't do this, but like in an NPR show, where, because they always have music coming in and out and little breaks, and like the NPR and the public radio shows are formed like traditional radio shows, and this really isn't. This is really its own thing, and it would even make more sense like on the Twit Network, which I know we probably shouldn't talk about because they hate us or something. But
I was just a guest on their Tech News Today. I'm not universally hated.
Anyway, their shows. Honestly, I haven't listened to many of them in a little while, but the way they were back when I listened to them is they sounded much more like traditional radio shows, like traditional talk radio shows. So it might even make more sense for them to have that kind of audio bedding or the music bedding under their ad reads, because like that make like their shows sound like radio shows, whereas your shows don't. Your shows sound like this new kind of thing. Your shows sound like, you know, quote, authentically digital, you know, to use Microsoft's terms, like native podcasts. So that's why I think it didn't work here.
Well, it's nice of you to say.
Thank you. So, moving on from that, TextMate 2 development seems to have slowed down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right? So it went through most of, let me hear, let's see the change log here, most of the summertime, and especially like late summer, like let me see, like July, August, even September, TextMate 2 was having almost daily release builds to the beta channel. And now there was a release build this morning with a pretty short change log. And then the last one was October 1st. So it's definitely slowing down.
This is what you predicted would happen, by the way. You were one of the first to come out and say that it's going to slow down, and it did.
What I predicted back when it was getting the burst of activity, the main thing I predicted, I think, was, at least I hope, because this makes sense, the main thing I predicted was that they would get a whole bunch of low-hanging fruit, but then like the really big shortcomings or big problems wouldn't really ever get addressed. The good thing is that's pretty much right. They did get a ton of low-hanging fruit. And if you look at this changelog, it really is a lot. I mean, they have fixed a lot of bugs. They've solved a lot of small shortcomings. And so now, TextMate 2 is about as useful to me as TextMate 1, but with actually some better, newer features as well. So I think if TextMate 1 solved your needs pretty well. I think you can safely try TextMate 2 for a while. But I think it has a similar number of major flaws as TextMate 1, which, you know, things like performance on very large files being pretty rough, and things like that. So it's not amazing, but it's good, and I am using it again. I stopped using Sublime and Chocolat for now, because it just fits me better. Like, if you're really into the TextMate look and feel, the TextMate conventions, the integration with various things, it's probably an easier thing for you to try TextMate 2 than it is for you to try Sublime or Chocolat or any of the other ones. Anyway, so I'm using it for now. I hope it continues to be useful. At least it is being developed at all. So now, you know, I'm confident that, let's say OS 10.9 comes, what are we on, 10.8 now? What's the next one? Yeah, we're on 10.8 now. Yeah. God, these things are moving so fast.
Yeah.
Kids these days. So when 10.9 comes out, you know, say that some big problem prevents TextMate 2 from launching. Now I'm at least confident that somebody will go and fix it fairly, you know, fairly soon after the release of 10. whatever. So, like, it no longer feels abandoned. Now it just feels like, it feels like they pretty much consider it feature complete, and they're just working on like minor tweaks here and there and bug fixes. So it's basically now to the point where TextMate 1 was for most of those years, where TextMate 1 didn't get new features added to it for a very long time. It was just on like this very slow release, bug fix only kind of cycle. So now I think TextMate 2 is at the beginning of that, which is, you know, once a month is still way more often than TextMate 1 was updated during the last few years. But I think this is now, like, I think now it's going to be, you know, what you see now, this is what you get. This is what TextMate 2 is. And it's not going to really ever solve the big shortcomings that it has now. But fortunately, there aren't that many of those. And for me, they don't get in the way. So I like it a lot. So I'm sticking with it.
Do you think there's any reason that people should be using TextMate 1 these days?
I think if you're really into it, and like, because, you know, as we've talked about at length, if you're really into a text editor, there's no immediate demand to go change things up, because even TextMate 2 does have a learning curve. It does do some things differently than TextMate 1. It actually does a lot of things differently, but most of them aren't likely to be a problem for you. But for me, like, I like TextMate 2 a lot. It took me probably a month before I was as productive in 2 as I was in 1. And any kind of change you make has that kind of learning curve. I think if you're going from TextMate 1 to any other alternative, I think TextMate 2 will be the easiest one to adapt to and the fastest one to get productive in, because it's so much more similar to TextMate 1 than any of the alternatives are, of course. So if you want to make a jump, TextMate 2 is probably the easiest one to jump to. But if you don't need to make a jump right now, there's no real pressure to do so until TextMate 1 stops working. And that, you know, we don't see any events on the near horizon that might cause it to happen. You know, Apple's not about to change languages or anything. They're not about to change architectures, although there's that ARM rumor. But, you know, even that, if that happens, isn't likely to happen for a while. So, you know, there's nothing on the horizon that looks like it's going to break old apps anytime soon. So we'll see. We'll see what next year's WWDC brings. But I think it's pretty safe for now.
And how should people be? Should people go to the trouble to, like, go to the GitHub and try to compile it themselves? Or should they just get the...
Oh, I don't know. I never do that. No, I installed the alpha. It recognized my license for TextMate 1, so I guess that's what qualifies me to have the alpha. Or is it a beta now? Is it still an alpha? Who knows? It's an alpha. Okay. And then I just, in the settings, you can say, like, you know, automatically check for updates and then watch for either normal releases or nightly builds. And I just pick nightly builds. And it's not actually nightly, but it's, you know, it's at most nightly. They don't release 2 in 1 day or anything. But that would be crazy talk. Anyway, all right, let's move on. Talk about the magazine.
Want to do a quick sponsor first, or do you want to?
Absolutely. Wanna... I love quick sponsors.
You like that. Lynda.com is our first quick sponsor. They're an online learning company with more than 77,000 video tutorials. You want to learn how to write Objective-C? You want to learn how to write PHP like Marco? Well, this is the place to go and do it. You want to learn design? It doesn't matter what you want to learn because they've probably got a class for it. They work with folks who are all around the world, all over the place. These are people who really know what they're doing, and they work with them to make courses that you can learn. You can learn on the go. By the way, they have a mobile site. They've got an iPhone and iPad app for members. They've got everything from tiny little tutorials to comprehensive courses. It doesn't matter what the topic is. They probably have it, like I mentioned, from 3D art and animation. They've got audio video stuff. They've even got business stuff, photography stuff on there. It's very, very cool. They add courses every week. And that keeps you up to date so that once you become a member over there, you can watch as much stuff as you want. You get unlimited access. You get 24/7 access to all of the stuff that they have with their expert instructors. It starts at $25 a month. You're not making a long-term commitment, and you can watch everything in that time. Try them free for 7 days. You go to Lynda, L-Y-N-D-A, lynda.com/5x5. And just going there and looking around, just using that URL will support the show. So thanks very much to Lynda for making this show possible. I still have an alpha on mine. Mine is reporting alpha 2.0.0-alpha.9321.
Yeah, that's the one from today.
Yeah.
Anyway. So we spent a couple of recent episodes talking about my various design decisions with the magazine and technical implementation details and things like that. I have a little more of that for the main topic today, to use John Syracuse language, the main topic. Who am I kidding? This show doesn't have a topic. This show never has a topic, but I'll try. All right, so lots of people have been asking me about pagination, how I support this in Instapaper. I have lots of different scroll. I have tilt scrolling, which is, you know, you tilt the phone, it automatically scrolls. I have pagination or regular scrolling. And even within pagination, there's two different kinds. There is the fast pagination, which used to be the only kind. And then there's the iBook style, which has that giant page curl animation as you, and, you know, you can pick up the page and hold it and flip it around and you know, just like iBooks. And that's easy to do. That's you know, from the UI page view controller in the API, which any app can use it from iOS 5 and up. Lots of people asking about this, and there was a recent discussion between a few people online about pagination versus scrolling. And I think Dr. Drang's post was the most recent that was substantial, I think, and kind of summed up some of the arguments. I linked to it in the show notes. I think what this comes down to, the arguments of pagination versus scrolling, which is better, which is, you know, is one of them just old? Like, is pagination just around because it's old? Is it around because is it a relic of the mouse? Or, I mean, is scrolling a relic of the mouse? Is pagination a relic of the page? Now that we have these touch devices, should they behave like pages or like mice? And there's all sorts of arguments on both sides. I think it's one of those things like light backgrounds versus dark backgrounds that there's really no right answer that will satisfy enough people. That most people with Instapaper, I don't actually do analytics on this, but I know from customer feedback and from people who have told me about how they use the app and from watching people use the app, I know that most people just scroll. That by far, scrolling is the most chosen way to progress through an article. Most people don't use tilt scrolling or pagination. And I mean, you can even look, my competitors have never offered tilt scrolling, and only in the last couple of months they started adding pagination features. So they, you know, they got along just fine for years without either of those things. Really, most people don't use these things. Most people just scroll. And whether that doesn't indicate which one is better necessarily. It just indicates what people do. So with pagination in the magazine, I didn't ship it in version one because it's complicated. It is really not easy to do. And iBooks has an easier time than most because iBooks calls a lot of private WebKit APIs. The iWork apps, Apple had some kind of design goal with them that I heard about where the iWork apps attempt to only use public APIs. So you have, you know, Pages, Keynote, and Numbers on iOS only apparently use public APIs, or at least almost use only public APIs, whatever that would be. iBooks does not have that restriction at all. It never has. iBooks has always called tons of private APIs. And so iBooks does things with WebKit that make pagination way easier to implement. We don't have that luxury as developers that aren't Apple. And I wonder if there's some kind of internal friction between like the iBooks team and the iWork team, because like you guys are cheating. Anyway,
who sets up those rules? Who's making that determination?
I don't know. Do you want to just say Scott Forstall, because everyone else?
Yeah,
is blaming
I'm pretty him. Sure that's why he was ousted from the company is because Forstall. He set that rule and no one was happy about it.
Oh boy, yes.
I guarantee it. Look it up.
Scott Forstall permitted iBooks to use the private APIs.
That's right.
Wouldn't let the iWork team do it.
That's right. That's why he's out. Good riddance.
That was it. He wouldn't sign the letter saying I'm sorry for using private APIs. All right, so. It's very easy for iBooks to do pagination. It's very hard for apps to do it. We have to do tons of crazy hacks. And, you know, there's three big challenges in implementing pagination. One is, how do you figure out where to break the pages? So with pagination, I guess you could do it by having like one web view per page, but that would be very memory intensive and slow. So the way I do it, I'm not sure. I think my competitors do it the same way, because there's a few ways you can tell. The way I do it is you just have one big web view the same way you always do, and pagination is simply a mode that you can put it in where it only shows you one page at a time. So, and then, you know, and when you turn pages, it's just scrolling that web view, but it's scrolling it by a set amount that it knows, okay, this page goes from, you know, height 800 to height 1600, et cetera. The hard part is determining where to break those pages. So if you have some giant, you know, 500 kilobyte text web page, that's going to be pretty long. The whole thing has to be loaded into memory. How do you look at that and say, all right, the user wants to view page 14. Well, what is page 14? Where does that start? Where does that end? Et cetera. So that's challenge number one. Challenge number two is, how do you then transition between pages? How do you show that animation? What do you do? Do you capture the image of one and slide it away manually while you're displaying the other one under
right.
it? Or do you let Core Animation handle it, which is way faster? And because then you don't, especially in the iPad 3, you don't have to call render in context. Do you let Core Animation do it, but then you're limited by the animations that it has available? Well, that's how my fast pagination mode works. It just uses the Core Animation transitions, which is why it's so fast. The iBook style pagination uses that UI page view controller. The challenge with that, this is the third major challenge, is if you try to use that, you have to restructure things dramatically, because UI page view controller, it doesn't just say like, you know, give me an image for page one and page two. It needs separate view controllers for every page. And without getting too into the details for people who aren't iOS developers, this is very complicated. And when you only have one big web view that you're scrolling behind the scenes, trying to cram it into UI page view controller is both complicated and slow. And this is the problem Instapaper had with the iPad 3, why it was so slow. So to make it fast, I had to add complexity. You know, I had to add various types of caching and optimizations and really various types of hacks to make it faster. And as most developers know, when you start going into like hacks to optimize things and make things faster and caching and everything, the opportunity for bugs multiplies tremendously. So it's not a very good solution. You know, you do that when you have to, but ideally you keep things simple. So for me to add pagination to Instapaper required tons of complexity, lots of very difficult programming problems, and tons of hacks and optimizations to make it fast, especially to make the iBook style pagination, to make that fast on the iPad 3. So for me to add, and by the way, there are still bugs that I haven't figured out with it. I mean, it is not a perfect implementation by any means. And that drives me crazy, and I'm still working on that. So to add pagination to the magazine, I would basically first have to incur the complexity of figuring out how to paginate things. That's easy because I already did that for Instapaper. I know how to paginate web pages really well. So that, in fact, I have like four different ways to do it.
I was
going to
say that's probably part of your framework that you've built.
Well, it's not because of the complexity. You can't just like bolt it on anywhere, but it mostly works. So that I can do. However, it still requires all of those hacks and complexities to make it fast if I want to do iBook style pagination. So the question would be like, you know, do I only offer the old kind, fast pagination, or not? So that's, and I think with version one, I think I would want to only offer that because it's so much simpler. And so much, with so many fewer bugs by far, and the potential for way fewer bugs. So there's that. The other thing is interface complexity. No matter whether I do iBook style or fast pagination, there's still a certain degree of interface complexity that shouldn't be overstated or shouldn't be understated. First of all, you have to have some way for people to select whether they want it paginated or scrolled. You can try, like my Instapaper competitors have done this with gestures, like you just flip to turn a page, and that has various issues. One of the big problems with the magazine would be that the swipe from left to right gesture already does something that already pulls up the sidebar. And if you had pagination on, I would have to disable that and either give it some other gesture, like a two-finger pull, which nobody would ever figure out, or just let people use the button. Because in the upper left corner, there's a button that pulls out the sidebar for you for people who don't know that you can swipe. But on iPhone, that button is fixed to the top, as I discussed last time. So on iPhone, that button scrolls away as you read the article. So to pull out the sidebar, you'd have to go to the top of the article again.
Right.
Which, if you're in the middle of reading an article and you want to come back to it, but you want to temporarily go to a different one, that's no good. And for me to solve that problem, I'd have to make a toolbar on the iPhone that's always there. But then if I have a toolbar, I'll have to make a full screen mode. As I discussed last time, like full screen modes suck. I hate full screen modes. I hate that I need one on Instapaper. I wish I didn't. I really hate that. And that adds tons of code complexity as well. And interface complexity and annoyance. So you start thinking about like, you know, okay, if I add pagination, I'll have to do this and this and this. It'll add this complexity. It'll have this cost over here. It'll have this cost in the interface. It'll have this cost in maintainability and testing. It'll run like crap on the iPad 3 if I do the iBooks animation. But if I don't do the iBooks animation, it'll look bad. Like there's all sorts of costs to that. So my current rationale is I don't think it's worth it. I don't think enough people use it in Instapaper. Like I know how few people use it. So I don't think it's worth all those costs and all that complexity to add it to this app that hasn't had it yet. You know, it's enough people use it, myself included, in Instapaper that it's not worth removing it. But now that I have this other app that has never had it, why add it back now? So I don't think I'm going to do it for the magazine, but time will tell. You know, if in the future, if I can, you know, I mean, someday I will be able to drop support for the iPad 3. Which sounds crazy now, but you know that's probably you know 3 or 4 years away. I can probably drop support for the iPad 3, and maybe then I could just do iBook style pagination, and it would be so fast that it wouldn't matter. But who knows? We don't really know that yet, and so I'll see in the future. But for now, I really don't think I'm going to do that.
It's really cool to hear you go through all of these different decision points for you, because it's not, again, and this happens all the time for people. I think we do have a lot of developers listening to the show. I think we have a lot of developer curious folks listening to the show. And this is the thing that I remember from the many years that I spent doing software development for clients or working in a company where I was doing it. And you'd get somebody who's like, well, can't you just make it? You can't just add this. Like, it seems like a simple feature. Just, this is how it's going to work, right? And you're like, well, yes, it does seem like a simple feature, but here's all the things that it will affect. And you give them this list of like 30 things and other decisions. And this is a great example of something that externally seems like a really simple thing for you to just add. Can't it just be a preference? Toggle it? But in reality, no, it's a very complicated thing. Or can be, potentially.
Exactly. There's all these other... and. Not just implementation details, but things like the interface costs that most people don't think about when they say, oh, I want feature X, Y, and Z. even if the, if those things are free, you know, quote, free to implement at the code level, at the back end of them, okay, where do you put the controls for that in the interface? How do you do that? And then what cost does that, what cost do that have? Does that have? That's a weird plural. What cost does that have?
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, what compromises are we going to have to make? You know, as we see with Microsoft, compromises always are necessary. Like you can't just say, we want everything with no compromises. That doesn't work. That's not reality. So there's always some kind of downside or costs to implementing new features. Even if the core of them, like their core functionality is simple and won't require any ongoing maintenance, there's always that cost. There's always like, okay, you have to put a setting or a button for this somewhere, or you have to have a gesture to do this or some way to do this. And there's going to be support costs from people who do it wrong or can't figure out how to do it or think you don't have it. You're going to have one-star reviews from people who can't find it if they can't find it. There's so many costs to everything. And it's about decision-making. And this is a core part of design. I hate when people just think design is graphics. That's so not the case at all. You know, there's all the design decisions behind behind all these features. It's, do you add this at all? And if you do add it, where do you put it? And what do you do? And you know, to use a Merlinism, what are you willing to give up to make that happen? Because you can't just add everything constantly for free and give up nothing. It doesn't work.
Well, I like hearing how you go. And this is kind of the difference, I think, in the deeper underlying philosophy of like, and I don't want to pick on Android, but let's, you know, between an Android app, which, well, we'll give them every feature. We'll give them everything. We'll implement everything. And the folks who, are, you know, are doing iOS, who are saying, well, what do we actually need? What can we avoid adding? What can we say no to? What kind of constraints should we put in for ourselves?
It's really, you know, I've talked about this a few times before, and I've written about it before. In my Microsoft Surface launch day blog post, I said at the bottom that, you know, there's this difference in philosophy between Apple's products and Microsoft's products. And you can kind of put Android in the Microsoft category here. You know, Apple's products are opinionated and controlling. And you know, the Apple message is, you know, we won't let you do that thing because we think it would suck. And the Microsoft message / Android message is, we'll let you do whatever you want, even if it does suck. And you know, you just have to deal with that. But we'll let you do it if you want to. Like it puts the user in more control in ways that might not necessarily benefit them. But it does put them in more control. So it gives them the rope to hang themselves with, you know, like it. And some people want that control. And this is a major cultural difference in the companies and in the products and in the customers between these two worlds of, give me more control and let me shoot myself in the foot if I want to. Mm-hmm. But damn it, I want more control. This is the whole political argument too. There's so many political arguments and policy arguments rest on this. Gun control, drug laws. Like there's so many parallels. And you can tell in the larger political world, you can tell there really is no right answer for everyone. It's like, you know, it's like like light versus dark. And like there's no answer that's going to please enough people to make it the only answer. So there's always going to be Apple or somebody like Apple doing the philosophy of, we're going to let your things be less flexible and do less, but do those things very well, and you're going to like it. And people will say, yes, that's what I want. We like that. And there's also always going to be somebody else saying, we're going to be, quote, open, whatever the hell that means. We're going to be open and we're going to let you do more things. You can install apps from whatever malware sites you want and stuff like that. And there's always going to be people who are going to say, yes, I want that and I'll handle it. And if my phone or my computer gets a virus or breaks or needs to be reinstalled, I'll handle that too. I'll take that risk. There's always going to be people who want to be on either side of this divide. And so this divide will always exist. There's always going to be products on both sides. And neither of them are ever going to, you know, languish into obscurity, really.
That's so depressing.
Yeah. And I think also the reason why Apple had such a terrible couple of decades there in the middle Or was it just one decade that was terrible? Or it was pretty much two, right?
Well,
anyway, the reason why they had such a terrible time there in the middle there was because they were doing a bad job, really. Like, it wasn't because Open was winning.
No, that's
Microsoft
true.
Is anything but Open. I mean, let's be realistic here. It wasn't that Open was winning. It's because Apple was doing a bad job and screwing up. You know, Apple was its own demise during that time. It wasn't that everyone just loved Microsoft that much. So,
you know, it's funny because think about this though. Yeah. Back in that time period, we'll just call it the Windows era. I remember I was working as like an IT guy and I was managing a few hundred computers in the office that I was in, which was like the headquarter corporate office. And then behind the scenes, we had Unix servers. They were Solaris boxes. And my main computer at home was always a Mac. Like, I still had PCs. I used to build PCs. We've talked about this. But I remember at the time, I was always frustrated because I was like, Apple should have made a bigger play for the enterprise. They should have focused on getting into the enterprise and making money that way. They should build things that support Exchange and all this other stuff, and they never really did that. And now,
where are those companies now?
Exactly. I mean, look at that now. And I'm not saying that Apple was like knew this and said no, we're going to come out with some amazing consumer devices. Like, I don't think this was necessarily their plan. Maybe it was. It'd be genius if it was. Maybe it was. But yeah, look at it today, and you know that like nobody wants to focus on enterprise today. It's all cool consumer electronic stuff. It's all about style. It's all about design decisions. And now look at what Microsoft is doing there and have been trying to do going back. Was the Zune the first time you think Microsoft actually really tried to get into like the consumer space in a different way?
Was the Zune before the Xbox? I don't think it
no,
was.
No, it was Xbox first. Yeah, you're right about yeah, that.
So that, I mean, that was, I think that was pretty clearly, you know, let's try to, I mean,
do you feel like gaming consoles are in the same place though as like a personal device, like a phone or a Zune? Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it's not 100% overlap with the market, but it's certainly a lot
in that space.
Yeah. It's, and it was their first time selling non-trivial hardware. You know, they've sold mice and keyboards for years before that, but it was Microsoft's first, like, this is our hardware device. We're selling this all in one. And the funny thing is the Xbox really is almost Apple-like, and you know, this is a device that we control the hardware and the software. It's all locked down. Although a modded Xbox is actually very useful, but and people figured it out. But you know, at least in theory, this thing is all locked down, and you know, we're going to control everything, and it's going to be good. And it was good. The first Xbox, the 360, I could, you know, there's arguments both ways, but the Xbox One was extremely innovative, and. Did I cover this already? I don't remember. This was how many episodes of the show? I don't remember. But back when Syracuse was talking about consoles and their innovations, the Xbox One introduced so much innovation. It had the hard drive, the network port, the controller disconnects. You know, like there's all like the whole, there's so many things with the dashboard. Xbox Live, like that was all Xbox One. Like there's, it did a ton. It used PC hardware, which, you know, kind of went both ways, but It was really a very, very good game system, and still is quite useful if you have a modded one running emulators. All right, so
second sponsor.
Let's move on.
Yeah, Squarespace.com. Everything you need to make an amazing website, fully hosted. It's completely managed. You go there, create a site. That's basically it. Doesn't matter what you want to do. You want to do a blog? You can do that. You want to do a portfolio? You can do that. You want to do a corporate site? That's fine. You want to integrate all of these things into one, build out a whole site that has every one of them? You can do that too. It's very cool. This is the thing that I like about Squarespace. You get to decide as a user. You get to decide how complicated you want to make things. You want to make it very complicated? You want to make a site that has many, many levels and sub-levels? You can do it. You want to have a simple thing that's just a gallery? You can do that too. You are a developer and you want to control every single bit of CSS, HTML, JavaScript, and you want to do that with Git, you can do that with their developer account. I mean, it really doesn't matter. And the beauty of it is, no matter what level you're at, you still get all the same advantages. You get to integrate with things like Twitter and Facebook. You get their really awesome stats, which is like a real-time stats thing. You get the drag-and-drop layout if you want it. It's got built-in SEO when you're writing an article. And this is the thing that I love about it, is it when you, after you've built this thing, unlike the stuff that Marco and I build, which really only we should be using. Well, Marco is different. I'm talking about the CMS stuff. Remember last time you were talking about the CMS behind the scenes? Like, that's just
even Second Crack. I say in the fact you shouldn't use this.
It's just for you. Like, and that's the thing. Like, people have said, "Oh, I want to do a podcast thing. Can I use 5x5 CMS?" Like, no. I'm embarrassed that my co-hosts have to see it. This thing is designed for people who are not experts, as well as experts who want additional configuration. The folks who don't know a thing about it and who just want to sit down with like a WYSIWYG editor and type. Like, that's there for them, and they're not going to break anything. And you can look at it on iOS because all their templates are responsive. They've thought of everything. Go to squarespace.com/5x5. You sign up for a year, you get 20% off. Sign up for 2 years, you get 25% off. Or you can just sign up for the $10 month-to-month plan and use the code DanSentMe11, and you will get 10% off whatever you do over there. But go and try it out. squarespace.com/5x5. What you got? What's the next big thing?
I'm trying to figure out when to put this coffee thing in the show.
Let's do it.
Let's do it now.
Yeah.
Get back to the magazine stuff. All right.
I'm drinking coffee right now. Your favorite
as you're talking? That's well, pretty impressive.
Well, not the same, but in between statements.
You weren't gargly at all. Question from Brian Daly, or Daly, I don't know. I think Daly. Does Marco know of any good low-acid coffees? As we have gotten older, my wife and I have found that the acid in coffee can lead to indigestion. I've heard that cold filtered coffee can also help with this. Have you tried cold filtering coffee? Okay. There's a couple of questions in here. Number one, yes, I've tried cold filtered coffee. It's also called cold brew coffee or the toddy method. I don't think there's really a lot of variation in the various cold brew methods. You pretty much submerge grounds in water for a long time, and then either they fall at the bottom very slowly, like the cool Japanese ones, or you just filter it very slowly or something. Somehow you just, you know, submerge coffee grounds in water for a long time, you know, hours in the fridge or something, and then, or you let it drip forever without hot water. So that's the basic gist of it. I don't like cold brew coffee taste. It doesn't do anything for me. Cold brew coffee tends to extract what I think of as like the bottom half of the flavor profile. It doesn't get what I think coffee people call the bright parts of the flavor. I don't know. All these flavor terms, like, it's like when wine people say something is, you know, earthy, which means it tastes like poop, or like oaky, you know, that tastes like crap. Like, there's all these terms with describing taste that are very difficult to figure out for a lot of people. So I think what I'm talking about is the brightness of the flavor, which is kind of like the tart. Almost a hint of sour in some beans. That part of the flavor is usually missing completely from a cold brew, and I assume it's because the hot water extracts that better from the beans, and the cold water really doesn't extract it. I assume, but I'm not sure much with the science behind that. I don't know enough about that. So for now, I will stop talking about that part of it. It is certainly plausible that cold brewing is lower acid. I've heard people say that. It's tricky, though. When you say low acid, you have to clarify what you mean by that. You know, do you mean like the pH being low, being less acidic than before? You know, like that's one thing.
That's like the technical definition of acidity, but maybe they mean, right, you know.
Or is it like extracting certain acids from the bean?
Right.
You know, that's a little bit vaguely defined a lot of times. So moving on, I think the science behind whether there is any kind of benefit to quote low acid coffee, I think is pretty weak, or at least undetermined. So I tried to find before the show, some kind of scientific evidence that low acid coffee actually is easier on the stomach. Because first of all, there's two effects here that people could be talking about. If drinking coffee makes you have to poop, that's because of the caffeine. And any coffee that has a meaningful amount of caffeine will have that effect on you. So low acid coffee won't help that. If that's your problem, then it's not going to matter.
Maybe it's more like the heartburn thing.
Right. So that, I think, is the more common thing that people want out of a low acid coffee. They want the reduction in heartburn. And heartburn, of course, covers a whole bunch of things. You know, acid reflux is maybe more accurate. I'm not really sure about that. But I tried finding a study about this, and the only evidence I could find was there's a company called Pure Roast that I guess they make like a mass market low acid coffee that competes with like Folgers and Maxwell House. I guess you can go to the grocery store and buy their coffee. I don't know. I don't look in the coffee aisle in the grocery store anymore. But the only study I could find was sponsored by them. And I linked to it in the show notes. I'll link to it here in the chat so you guys can see it as well. And they issued this press release about it. And it says, quote, the results, blah, 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 by this guy, gastroenterologist, showed that 90% of gastroesophageal reflux disease sufferers could drink Pure Roast low acid coffee without the usual stomach upset symptoms. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, right.
That sounds like a huge difference. So then I just pasted this link in the chat. Then I went to try to find the source. That's just a press release that was published on Reuters and through PR or whatever. So then I went, okay, let me go find, 90% of people said that, that this fixed their problem. That's amazing. So the source of this on their site, they have an overview PDF on the Pure Roast site from this Dr. Arthur Euler, MD. It's basically just showing the summary of findings. It's only like 3 pages long, the summary of the study. So it says, let me go through this a little bit by bit here. It says, low acidity is seen as a positive factor influencing product selection by a significant majority of the purchasing public. Okay, citation? Nothing. All right. This was also true among our customers because they rated Pure Roast coffee lower acid content as the most important factor in making their initial Pure Roast coffee purchase. Okay, so in other words, what this means is they bought it because it claimed to be low acid. Now, if you think about it, this is extremely vulnerable to the placebo effect. They bought this thing because it was advertised as low acid. They bought it because they want a low acid coffee. So they are suffering from some kind of problem that they want this to fix. Very, very vulnerable to placebo.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one. The study continues. They all had experienced some annoying or distressing upper gastrointestinal symptoms when they drank flash roasted coffee, which is like regular. Most customers, 58%, attempted to lessen these symptoms by reducing their coffee intake, while fewer entirely stopped drinking coffee and or tried decaf coffee. Despite these attempts, the customers continued to seek alternatives and eventually found the Pure Roast coffee website. Okay, let's break this down. In other words, the participants all bought the coffee to solve this symptom, and they came to this website of this company, and it sounds like they filled out a survey. This was not a scientific study, but this is the result of a survey on the Pure Roast website among people who already bought it, who came to the website to fill out a survey about it. Okay, so already the credibility of this is pretty poor, because this is not like a study done on a random selection of people who have these, GI problems. It is obviously not a blind study, because people who bought this coffee wanting it to solve this problem for them, and then they went to the website and filled out a survey about how it solved the problem for them. So this is very, very scientifically weak. All right, it continues. After drinking Pure Roast coffee, the customers found that rather than having the GI symptoms they had experienced previously when they consumed convection roast coffee, their symptoms were actually partially or completely relieved in the vast majority, 76%, when they drank Pure Roast coffee. Okay, so among people who bought the coffee for the purpose of helping their stomach issues, then went to the website and filled out a survey about it, which shows obvious strong cognitive investment into this product working, 76% of those people said it partially or completely relieved their stomach issues. Okay, and then the study continues. The vast majority of these thought Pure Roast's good taste was more significant flavor characteristic, while the smoothness, well, so a bunch of people said it tasted good. Because these customers could drink Puro's coffee without developing their usual gut symptoms at all, or to a much lesser degree, together with their liking Puro's coffee flavor, over 95% of the customers said they would recommend Puro's coffee to their family and friends and buy Puro's again. Okay, hold on a sec. So the original press release said 90% of GI sufferers could drink this coffee without the usual stomach upset symptoms. This last line here says over 95% said that, you know, because they could develop, they could drink it, they would without having these symptoms, they would recommend it to their friends and family or buy it again. But that's not what the study said a paragraph up. A paragraph up, it said only 76% said it actually helped their symptoms. So the rest said between 76 and 95, you know, the difference there are people who said they would recommend it or buy it, but who said it didn't actually help their symptoms. It just tasted good. So the numbers are all over the place here, and this is obviously not a very professionally done study at all, or even a professionally done survey for that matter, because the numbers, and who knows where the 90% in the press release came from? Who knows? As far as I can tell, everything else that I could find before the show was all about citing this study or citing nothing, but most the things that actually cited anything were citing this study. And obviously this has absolutely no scientific basis at all. That, you know, 76% of people who came to this website of this product who said they tried it at home said it might have helped them a little bit or fully. Like, so this needs a blind study done to really conclude anything. And this obviously was not that study. This is a horrible study. So I still don't think we have good evidence that lower acid coffee results in less upset stomach issues or acid reflux issues, because, you know, there's a whole bunch of complexity with how your stomach processes things. Your stomach produces its own acid, and quite a lot of it, and chances are the acid your stomach produces probably dramatically overpowers whatever you're drinking from a cup, whether it's, you know, less acidic by pH for this, for these 8 ounces that you're drinking or not. Probably doesn't matter a whole lot.
You ever dealt with gastrointestinal reflux disease?
I've never been diagnosed with anything like that.
Like heartburn.
I've occasionally had, like, you know, the acid throat feeling or an upset stomach. I mean, that's like, I can't really drink orange juice anymore because it does that to me.
I mean, people who, you know, like you're describing, people who've had to deal with this, like I had to deal with it for quite a while and was told, by the way, by the doctor that I'd be on the, what's this stuff they give you? Nexium?
I don't know.
They told me I would be on that for the rest of my life. And like I told him, no, I think I'm going to figure out a way off. And he just laughed. But by the way, meditation, yay.
That's the thing too. A whole lot of GI issues are exacerbated by psychological things like stress. And so it's very, like, it's so hard to do a scientific study on this kind of stuff. You really have to rule out placebo completely. You have to do a blind test.
You have to
have proper controls. And anything like this that is so heavily influenceable by the placebo effect, with something like this that has such a strong mental component, is really, really iffy.
Yeah. Sorry. And I was just saying, anybody who's had to deal with this, like if you're dealing with this, you want something, you want an alternative. You know what I mean? Like you're trying to find, like, giving up coffee was, for a lot of people, it can be the toughest thing ever. And they're like, please give me something that's low acid. So like, I totally understand where these folks are coming from.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, like when you want a solution to a problem so badly, you'll try anything.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You should have seen all the crap I tried when I was like 19, trying to get my hair to stop falling out and stop going bald. Oh my God. I tried all sorts of crazy crap. Of course, none of it worked. But I tried pretty much everything anybody has ever heard of. I tried it. Like anything that people have heard of to combat or reverse hair loss, I tried it when I was like 19 or 20, and none of it worked. Believe me, I tried it. even later than that, I was trying it for like 4 years. Because like I remember I was trying Propecia when I graduated from college. I was still doing it. So that's like 2004, 2005. I was still trying Propecia up to then. Like, yeah, it doesn't work. But I tried everything. I wanted everything to work. Of course, you know, then I had somebody, I forget who, somebody just told me, just buzz it. And so now, rather than paying like $60 a month for Propecia and dealing with whatever side effects that might have of a constant hormonal alteration in your body forever.
Right.
Or, you know, as long as you take it, but like a permanent, you know, for the rest of your life kind of thing, you know, as long as you take this, you're going to have this, this massive hormone change in your body. Or go to get a haircut twice a month for $16 at my awesome Italian barbershop and just have them buzz your hair and, you know, get a haircut that you would need anyway. Then it's way cheaper and there's no hormones and no thoughts of, I wonder what side effects this might be having over the year or two I've been taking this crazy pill. Turns out the best cure for hair loss is to just accept that you have to deal with it and just adapt accordingly. I highly suggest a very short haircut. Or if you can pull it off, just shave your head. I'm not sure I could pull that off, so I never tried that completely, but I'm probably trying in the future. But that's the major cure for hair loss. I'm revealing it right here. A buzz cut. That's it. Everything else, you're wasting your money, believe me. And you're only prolonging the inevitable of, you know, you have to accept it. You have to accept, you know what? I'm just going to be mostly or completely bald. And
what about plugs or hair transplants or plugs or something?
I had a consultation about that, actually. They told me that I didn't even have enough hair in the more dense areas to transplant it up to the less dense areas. So I was not a candidate for that. I my consultation ruled that out immediately. The whole industry of combating hair loss for men, for women, it's a little bit different, but the whole industry of combating hair loss for men, is really kind of sad.
And you know, Marco, it's not like you're the only dude that maybe is losing his hair.
Right. Exactly. Like, it's not, yeah, you know.
You're not like the one guy out of the 1,000 people in Brooklyn where you live that, you know, is walking around and doesn't have like a full thick head of hair like Mark DeChristina from MailChimp.
Sure. You know, granted though, when I was 19 and losing my hair,
yes,
it was a little early. But, you know, but now I'm 30. Who cares? Like, everyone, half people I know are bald.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter now, you know. It mattered a lot back then. I mean, I tried natural stuff. There was like a day or two where I had to. There's some quack book by some author called like Eat Right for Your Type. It's like a diet for your blood type.
Hmm. Oh, you know what? I've heard of that.
Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
My mom made me try this in high school for like a week, and I had to eat for whatever. I forget what type. I don't even know my blood type off the top of my head. But whatever my blood type was, the eating right for my type was like eating nothing except like meat on a plate. It was like nothing good. I couldn't eat anything good. And it was, I'm pretty sure there was no scientific study for that either, honestly. But, you know, my mom was into alternative medicine and natural stuff. So I tried homeopathy, which of course is a complete load of crap. Please email Dan. Complete load of BS, homeopathy. Oh man, that makes me angry. Just in general, homeopathy is completely a load of crap. And if you're into it, you can email Dan. I tried that. I tried like vitamins and special shampoos. I tried Rogaine for a while. Then I tried Propecia for a while. Everything, it just doesn't work. So it just doesn't work. And all that whole time, I had my denial haircut. Like I was keeping my old hairstyle as if I could still pull it off. That was, if you see early pictures of me at Tumblr, I still had that haircut until like 2008 or so. Before I was like, you know what? Enough people had convinced me to try the buzz cut that I tried at one time. And I was like, yeah, I never went back. The first time I tried the buzz cut, that was it. I was done. I never went back. Number two. One more sponsor? Or there's two more, right?
No, just one. Hover.com, simplified domain management. I wonder if you can see some of the denial haircut is my suggestion. I wonder if denialhaircut.com is available. Hover.com, they let you register. Now it's not. They let you register domains.
Hover.com to register a domain.
Yeah. Hover.com, you get 10% off if you use the code Dan sent me. You can go to hover.com/DanSentMe. That will support the show. It'll also automatically apply the 10%. You can use, if you're already, I get this question a lot. What if I'm already a customer? What if I just want to renew? Dan sent me 10% off. Everything you do over there, But they're really great folks. They want it to be easy for you to register a domain name. There's a search box. You type in the domain name. They'll show you some alternatives if it's not available, and that's it. You have one decision to make when you're checking out. Do you want free Whois protection? I just leave the box checked. They don't upsell you. They don't do, well, we actually are registering you for 3 years. Sorry, we didn't tell you till you check. No, it's straightforward stuff. And they pretty much leave you alone. And if you want to never hear from them, there's a little checkbox in your settings page where you uncheck the box and they will never bother you again. And they're really, really great folks. So you can go there, hover.com/DanSentMe. They get built-in DNS management. They get email hosting as an add-on if you want it and more. Check them out, hover.com/DanSentMe, 10% off. Right now, Denial Haircuts, plural, is available.
No, it's singular.
But it's got to be singular.
Yeah, it has to be. How that's about denialhaircut.info? We can use one of those various TLDs only ever used for spam and porn sites.
Denialhaircut.com is still available. 10% off if you use that code. Go! I bet you by the next 10 minutes, it'll be gone.
I told you, I think I said on this show like a long time ago, how when I was doing the Tumblr registration CAPTCHA, CAPTCHA so much. Yeah. And by the way, why I said this before, but I'm saying it again because everyone's still using it. Why are we still using reCAPTCHA? Anybody who uses reCAPTCHA on their any web developer who is responsible for making other people go through reCAPTCHA on a regular basis,
yeah,
should have to go through it themselves once a day. Just like to unlock their computer, their password login screen should have a reCAPTCHA on it, so that they know when it's okay and when it's getting bad. And right now, it's getting really, really bad. And because the way reCAPTCHA works with the whole like Google book scanning thing or something like that, all of the easy to discern words have been used. Those are all done. So now, what you have to type into reCAPTCHA is usually like I'm seeing with myself roughly a 50% failure rate with typing those in.
Yeah, it's gotten so bad. Yeah, totally. It's gotten worse, and it seems like every day it's getting worse. When I go to a site and I can actually read what it says and type it in, like it's like a party.
Yeah, it's crazy. So anyway, back when I was doing Tumblr's CAPTCHA thing, we had to put some kind of CAPTCHA in because of spam registrations that were happening.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this. What kind of spam were you guys seeing on that for signups?
Well, there were two kinds. One was human spam. One was affiliate marketing blogs. That there was like one summer. There's some kind of organized affiliate marketing campaign called the 30-Day Challenge run by some douche. And He makes videos and stuff. He clearly is not the kind of person who I get along with. anyway, so he runs this coordinated 30-day challenge every summer, I think, like every July, I'm pretty sure, or August, something like that. And it's basically like one of those like be your own business, get rich at home kind of audiences where I don't know how he gets attention for these people, but somehow he's amassed a very large following of people who want to be their own bosses and get rich at home and have their own businesses. But all those businesses are making affiliate marketing spam all over the internet. And then you have like your keyword. I guarantee you anybody who has searched the internet in the last 3 years has seen the results of this, which is blogs that have like a certain key phrase of, it's some kind of usually product related thing, like best cedar lawn chairs and like some kind of specialized kind of niche. I don't know how to say that.
Man, nobody does.
Some kind of niche market of things that people might be searching for on Google, and usually product related or ebook related, because what they're selling, usually they have affiliate links to those scammy like paid ebooks. Of like, download this ebook for $3 and we'll tell you what the best cedar lawn chairs are. Or, you know, how to cure balding. You know, how to stop going bald at age 19. Click here to find this ebook here. I mean, the only reason they don't do stuff like that is it's too crowded.
Right.
But stuff like that, you know, things people are searching for. How to make Halloween decorations. So you see these blogs And they you can tell what the key phrase is immediately because it's always bolded. And they mention it like 20 times in each blog post. Here's how to make the bold best Halloween decorations and bold for today. If you want to make the bold best Halloween decorations bold this season, you like it's they repeat it over and over again because they think that's going to help them in Google.
Right.
And at one time it probably did. I think Google is smarter now, but at one time that helped. So the whole idea is when people search the web for that phrase, like if they search the web for baldness cures, some little affiliate marketing site is not going to rank very well. There's too much competition. The idea was to pick some kind of very small niche phrase that there's not much competition for, that people that still shows some kind of buying intent or some kind of intent to be monetizable somehow. And so anyway, you look over any kind of publishing network and it's filled with this crap. This is actually another big problem in the Amazon Kindle store when people could self-publish scammy and spammy ebooks. They do in large quantity, and Amazon is, I believe, trying to fight them, but it's a pretty big battle. So Tumblr was overrun at one point with these people. And the thing is, they're humans that are doing this. The humans are going and creating this, following this guy's instructions. I mean, it's kind of arguable whether they should qualify as humans, but biologically they are. So they... You know, they would go, and so if you put up a captcha, they'll get through it because they're you know, quote, human. They will get through any kind of traditional spam filter you set up. So that was a whole issue. Although the advantage with them is that these people were such sheep that they would all follow the formula exactly. So we'd be able to find them really easily because they would all use the same phrases, like the same padding phrases or the same template. Like they would all use this guy's formula so closely because they had no thought to themselves. They were it's kind of a hive mind, really. Or maybe they were zombies. I'm not sure biologically how we'd classify them, but they were not capable of independent thought. So it was fairly easy to find them in mass and penalize or block them or whatever. But obviously, any other web service has problems with bot spam. So if you have any kind of form, any kind of registration form, people can script it and then create 1,000 accounts per second to use as spam in other ways. So we implemented a CAPTCHA to protect against that a little bit, but I didn't want to put everybody through a CAPTCHA for every registration. So I had all these heuristics to say, okay, well, we're only going to show the CAPTCHA to people who we think are likely to be spam or more likely than the average visitor to be spam. So we will inconvenience only those people and we'll still catch almost all of the spam. So, you know, there's a few different ways you can do that. One of them is like, you know, we had a JavaScript thing in the forms that like if you weren't able to load JavaScript and process it to some degree, we would make you go through the CAPTCHA because that's one way to mostly rule out spam bots because most of them won't do that. I mean, and now, of course, they've gotten more sophisticated and they probably will do it now. But at the time, this was like 3 years ago I did this or more even. So, but one of them was if you had an IP address from Russia, just I think it was like 87 dot anything, I put you through the CAPTCHA because such a massive majority of the spam, of the automated spam was coming from Russia.
Oh, that's wild.
It was crazy. And so if you had an email address ending in .ru, you go through the CAPTCHA right. Anytime. And so anyway, the reason I got into this topic was with the hover thing. Same thing. If you had an email address ending in .info or .biz, I don't think I've ever seen a site that wasn't spam that ended in either of those things. And similarly, all of the spam email addresses that were used as username addresses or as user account addresses for Tumblr spam, so many of them were .info and .biz. Or if you had like a whole bunch of hyphens in the domain too, that was always a dead giveaway as well. But I mean, they were just, I don't think those, have you ever, besides MTA.info, which is a pretty good New York transit status thing, I think it's the only site I've ever seen that was a .info or .biz that wasn't spam. Have you seen any?
Yeah, I was thinking about this while you were talking about it. I didn't even know about that MTA thing at all, but no,
it's
mean
only from New York
because info is such a clumsy, unfortunate TLD that I mean,
not as clumsy as dot museum. That is real.
I don't know where we're going with those these days. But, no, I mean, the dot info is almost like the calling card of the folks who want to spam you. But they are. Amazing that that you were. So dot 87 dot. That's just Russia. There's no other. Nothing else would ever fall into.
There was one of the top level numbers that begins with 8, and I forget which one. I think it's 87, but it's like it's either all those are Russia or most of them are Russia. And yeah, so I guess that's it. If you appear to be from somewhere near Russia, you're going through the CAPTCHA because like. Some obscenely high percentage of those actually were spam. sorry, legitimate Russians. Title. It's not worth the lack of annoyance to them to have all that spam come in. Anyway, I guess we're pretty much, I had other stuff to talk about, but
what you got?
I don't want to run too long.
70 minutes. Syracuse has been pushing the 2-minute mark. I mean, 2-hour mark, rather.
I know. That's
it's crazy.
Well, his show is my current favorite podcast. So I like when he has a long show.
Me too.
I know you. He at least tries to end it more quickly.
Yeah, I never tell him anything like that. It's all
I'm sure
his thing.
He has people who don't want it to be that long. But I mean, with podcast length, any length you pick, there's going to be people who say, I want it to be shorter. And there's going to be other people who say, I want it to be longer. Doesn't matter. And so it doesn't really, like, what matters is the longer it is, the fewer people will be able to keep up with it every week. And that has, you know, that goes both ways. Like something, and if it's really good, like Syracuse show is really good. So if it's really good, people will be more willing to listen to a longer show. So, you know, I think the problem is if you have a really long, boring or bad show, then you'll have people drop off. Whereas if you have like a half hour show, that's consistently mediocre. More people will tolerate that because it's only a half hour, you know. But for a 2-hour show, it has to be pretty good. All right, I guess we're done. Let's end it here.
All right, you can go to twitter.com/MarcoArment ARMENT to follow him on Twitter. You can also go to alpha.app.net, and that's where he's just Marco over there, just like I'm just Dan there and Dan Benjamin on Twitter. You can read Marco's writings at marco.org. You should check out Instapaper. You can check out the magazine, both of which are in the iOS App Store, iTunes Store. What else we got? Is that it? That's where you're hiding out. Tentus. People, by the way, I get email from people who are saying, don't call it Tentus. It's tent.is.
Is it Tentees?
Tentees. So go to Tentees, Marco.
Honestly, I haven't used that since the day that I created that account. Yeah. I'm having enough trouble trying to figure out how to use both Twitter and app.net. Adding a third one is just not going to happen. I one of these has to win.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I'm using like HD DVD and Blu-ray at the same time and trying to figure out, okay, which one do I connect to the TV? Which one gets the HDMI input? Anyway.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in. Check out the sponsors and please consider rating the show on iTunes. Best way for new listeners to find it. And you can see all the show notes. Are there a lot? There are some. 5by5.tv/buildanalyze/103. That's where you can go to find all of the links that Marco and I have put in the show notes for you. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Have a great week.
You too.